Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 3rd, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Bruce Berner. It's session number 98-4, and it's titled, So You Want to Be a Lawyer? Let's listen in.
Good evening. My name is Bruce Berner, and I'm here, this is the end of my first week. I'll be here for 2 weeks at Holden, talking about various aspects of American legal culture. The program announcement today, I think we entitled it, So You Want to Be a Lawyer. I want to make it clear to everybody ahead of time, I don't want to talk anybody into being a lawyer who doesn't want to be a lawyer. Let's start with who in the room is a lawyer. Okay, so we're...
I acted pro se once, is that
huh? Yes, that's right. You did act pro se, you know how that goes. What I wanted to do tonight is to just give you a little bit of a taste of two things. First of all, what law students do, that is, what it's like to be a law student, what kind of things we do in class, what kind of preparation a young man or young woman goes through now to become a lawyer. When I was in law school in the 60s, if we would have a class of 55 or 60 or 65 people, we might have one woman. We might. Now, nationwide, it's 48% women, 52% men. So it's a very different kind of environment. I like it a lot better for a lot of reasons. For one thing, the women make the men better. For another thing, the women study harder. For the most part, they make better grades because they're a little more conscientious about it. Law school is a three-year program. It is very little of a professor standing in front of a classroom and lecturing for 50 minutes. It's a very interactive kind of learning. A lot of what goes on in the class is driven by what the students do. We may cover three or four cases in a day. Each of those cases is assigned to a student to report on, and then the student then the professor will do some questioning of the student about what the student read, maybe change the facts a little, ask if the case would be different if this had happened or if that had happened. Probably the scariest thing about being a law student, unlike most other kinds of education, is you all know when you went to school and high school and college, after about 4 or 5 weeks you'd get a test. And then after another 3 or 4 weeks you'd maybe write a paper. And then you take another test, and then finally there would be a final exam. Well, that way you would get some idea as you were going through how you were doing. You would get some feedback. Law schools have historically given one test at the end of the course. So you take a course all the way from August to December, 14 or 15 weeks, and then you take 1 4-hour final examination in that course. This builds in a lot of stress. And of course, some of that is intentional to build in a lot of stress. But one of the reasons for doing that is it's really not particularly easy to write a law examination about part of a course. Almost every question involves aspects from all different parts of the course. And so the idea of the final is it's the student's job to bring that all back together. Now, after the 3 years, unless they don't do very well, they get a degree from us. And then they go out, and before they can practice, they take what's called a bar examination. Depending on which state they want to practice in, they take another examination. That examination is typically 2 or 3 days in length. In most states, usually something like 18 to 25 hours of sitting in an examination, answering questions about all the courses that they've had in law school. So it's a rugged examination. They usually take a 6-week course, a refresher course, because remember, some of the things that they're going to be tested on, they had 3 years ago. And so the course brings that back. Now, once they begin to practice law, lawyers do all kinds of things. What do you think of when you think of a lawyer? What's the first thing you think of a lawyer doing? Don't say lie, please. Don't say lie or being mean or charging money. What activity do you first think of?
Arguing in court.
arguing in court. Yeah, I mean, our picture of the lawyer is the trial lawyer. We're in court and there's a dispute of some kind. Certainly that's what TV would lead us to believe. Almost all the dramatizations of what a lawyer does is trial lawyer, because frankly that's more interesting and it's easier to dramatize around. Actually, a very small percentage of practicing lawyers go into the courtroom deal with cases, what I call post-failure cases. That is, if a case is in court, the system has broken down already somewhere and we're just repairing the damage at that point. Most lawyers do what we usually call transactional work. That is, their job is to prevent the kind of disputes from arising that could lead to a lawsuit. So they draft documents, they draft policies for companies, they do a lot of things in their offices to prevent it from breaking down to the point where two people or two companies are so angry with each other that they have to go to court. The one thing we know from all the statistics is once you go to court, you don't win or lose, you lose. Even when you win, you lose. That is, the process is so tough, it's so expensive, except in a few cases. Most people, let me just say this, if you have a choice of being in court or not as a litigant, I'd just as soon pass it up. I'd just as soon go to the other session, you know, and avoid the whole thing if that's possible. The problem that I want to have us talk about, and let me say this real clearly, I'm going to be most comfortable when you're asking questions. So if there's anything you have a question about what we're doing, or even some general questions about law school or what lawyers do or what this process looks like, jump in and ask them. If I don't see your hands, it's because they've set this room up to blind the speaker. All the light's coming this way. You can probably see me, so that's your misfortune. I can't see you, that's my misfortune, right? Let's talk a little bit about this case. I'll tell you a little background of it. This comes up in a course that in law school we call torts, which is one of the courses I teach. And what really torts is the course in accidents. That is, what happens when someone suffers personal injury or property damage as the result of the actions of someone else. When can they recover money to cover their damages from the person who hurt them? So the most common kind of case of this type, of course, that we hear about is an automobile accident, right? One car hits another car, someone gets hurt, the person in that car sues the driver of the car that hit them, and now we have to decide if the driver who hit them should pay for their bills and for their pain and suffering and other damages. And sometimes, of course, those damages are terrible. Permanent damages. We call that whole field of accident law negligence law. There's a smaller part of it which deals with people who hurt other people on purpose, and that's called intentional torts. And there we have battery and assault and false imprisonment and that kind of thing. They're much less common. We get them. They're much less common. The ordinary stuff that a trial lawyer in torts does is deal with people who were injured accidentally. What they have to prove is that the other party was at fault. Our system says you can't make someone else pay for your injuries unless they were at fault. It's not enough to show that they caused your injury. You have to show that they were at fault. And the word we use to describe fault here is negligence. You've probably heard that word, but if you haven't, it's very similar to words we ordinarily use like carelessness. I might hurt you inadvertently, and it might not be my fault. It might be your fault. Or it might be nobody's fault. Some things are just nobody's fault. They're just an accident, it's a risky world we live in. If I walk along one of the trails here and a tree falls on my head, whose fault is it? Hard to find anybody at fault. Right? It's not my fault. We wouldn't want to say no one should walk on trails ever. And that sounds like a lot to ask, right? So every once in a while we find someone who's hurt and there's really nobody at all who's at fault. Then the person who's hurt has to bear the loss. Maybe they'll have insurance to cover that loss. And one of the primary reasons we carry insurance is in case the way we get hurt is not covered by someone else's fault, right? Raise your hand if you're carrying insurance, okay? For yourself, right? Now, if someone who is at fault hits you with their car, it turns out you don't need that insurance. You can collect the money from them. But you carry it because there's a lot of situations in which we get hurt where it isn't someone's fault. Well, we're going to look at a little case now, which is a negligence case, with a set of funny facts. Yes, sir?
But do you not indeed carry insurance to avoid all of the hassle? Let the insurance company do that.
Yes. At least that's true for what's called liability insurance. In other words, the insurance you carry to cover the fact that you might hurt someone else and have to pay their damages. And you raise a wonderful point. What most people don't realize is that when they buy that liability insurance policy, one of the most valuable things they have bought with it is a lawyer for free. Because if you get sued and it's a risk that's covered by your liability insurance carrier, you don't have to go out and get a lawyer. You simply phone the insurance company, say, I've been sued, turn over all the papers for them, they supply the legal counsel. The only time you might need to have a lawyer of your own in that situation is if the damages may be more than the limits of your insurance policy. And that's pretty rare, because for the most part, in this country now, most people are carrying pretty high levels of liability insurance. But if you have really low insurance, there may be cases in which you need to get your own counsel to protect yourself against the excess. Because once the insurance company says, we're fully liable, we're going to pay the full amount of the insurance, they don't care about it after that. Then they let you worry about it on your own. But that very seldom happens. And so, yes, one of the most valuable things that comes with that insurance policy is they pay for the lawyer if you get sued. Now, if you're the one that gets hurt and you're doing the suing, then that insurance doesn't buy you a lawyer. It's only the liability insurance that buys you a lawyer. If you can collect from your own insurance carrier through what we call like collision, right, insurance, or medical pay insurance, that is, in a car accident, you can carry insurance that says they'll pay medical bills, yes, then you're going to avoid a lawyer. But let's say you don't have that kind of insurance, and let's say you're the one that's hurt, you're not carrying any insurance for yourself, you have all these medical bills, but you think that the person who hit you was at fault. Now you can go and get a lawyer. How are you going to pay for the lawyer? You know how? Well, there's a variety of ways you can. You can work any deal you want with the lawyer, provided the lawyer agrees too, right? It's a contract, so both sides have to agree. You could theoretically pay the lawyer an hourly fee, or you could pay the lawyer a set amount. That is, you can sit down and say, I think this is worth X amount of dollars. But what happens in 98% of these cases is none of those, but a bargain in which the lawyer says, I will take nothing unless we get a judgment. I'll take nothing unless you get paid by the other party, and then I will take a percentage, an agreed upon percentage. And that can be anywhere, depending on where you are in the country, from 25% to 40%. And sometimes it's a sliding scale, so that as the amount goes up, the percentage goes down. Okay. That way, if your case doesn't win, you're not out of pocket. Paid no one. On the other hand, the lawyers now are careful. Do you see why? They don't want to take just any case that walks in. They want to analyze the case carefully enough to make sure it's legitimate, because they own, in effect, a share of your case. Well, one of the things we often hear is that, you know, lawyers sue like crazy. Lawyers are litigious. The truth is, a great percentage of a lawyer's time is devoted to talking people out of suing. Because lawyers know, for the most part, that if the suit isn't good, it's not going to help anybody to have that lawsuit proceed. Yes?
You invited the question.
So yeah, you bet.
You can table it if you want.
No.
Isn't this contingency fee unique to our system? The British English system doesn't do it this way, or the Australian system?
Almost all of the other systems have what's called a loser pays system. That is, whoever loses the lawsuit pays for the lawyers for both sides, their own lawyer and the lawyer on the other side. That very often is recommended for this country, and the people who recommend it say, look at all these frivolous lawsuits. Everybody's suing, and the lawsuits are getting crazier and crazier, and when you read in the paper, you can read about them. Let me just give you a caution. A lot of those stories are just not true. A lot of what you read in the paper, the lawsuits that were brought, they've given you about one-tenth of the story. What will happen, though, I fear, and what I think most people fear, is if we go to the loser pays system, we put such a disincentive to people, especially poor people, who have the hardest time getting access to the system anyway, they go, my goodness, you know, I think this is a legitimate case, but who knows if I'll win or not, these lawyers are crazy, who can figure this out? And so now if I lose, I owe my bills, and I owe the bills of the other side's lawyer, and Lord knows what he's charging. I don't even have control over what he's charging. I don't know ahead of time what it is. So that's why everybody's gone very, very, very slowly with that. You may also be referring to the fact that some countries have outlawed the contingent fee. The contingent fee is what I described, where a lawyer gets a percentage. And you can do that, but then what you have to say is, what, if you want to bring a lawsuit, then you have to pay an hourly fee, and you pay that win or lose. Every once in a while, a lawyer will take a case that's a very complicated case and spend 2 or 3 years of time working that case up, and that case loses. And then not only does the lawyer have nothing, but the lawyer may have a lot of money sunk into that case by way of expenses. So when you read about the cases where there's a big settlement and the lawyer gets a third of it, and you go, boy, that's a good job. I'd like to have that job where you get a third of $1 million every once in a while. Remember that there's an awful lot of other cases where the lawyer put a lot of work in and got nothing. I think what we need to do is to take a hard look at it and limit how high the contingent fee can go, and maybe say that the one-third ought to apply to the first X amount of dollars, but if we get one of these awards in the big numbers, then all the rest of that ought to go to the plaintiff. That will not make me popular with the American Bar Association, but it seems to me that that's a fairly sensible way to get in the middle of the problem. All right, let's take a look at this little set of things. Has everybody got a white sheet here? I know there's some up there on the rack for the people upstairs. This is just a little negligence case. But what I want us to do with this is to see how a lawyer might approach a typical case, what kind of things a lawyer might look for, what kind of research the lawyer might do, both in terms of the theory of the case and in terms of the facts of the case. What I'm going to do on this sheet is give you a big head start. Usually all a lawyer gets is someone walks in his or her office. And even to get as much as I have on the sheet, you have to do a lot of fairly skillful interviewing. But, hi, good evening. Come on in. Grab a, and if anybody else comes in, any one of those. I took this right from the exam I gave my tort students in May at the end of the spring semester at Valparaiso. So I know at least how 49 of my students attack this question. Some better than others, of course, is always the answer to that. But let's take a look at it. The North Lake Mall is a privately owned enclosed shopping mall open to the public. So it's just like any kind of suburban mall that you've ever been to. Responsibility for the areas inside individual stores rests with the individual tenants. Responsibility for the common areas inside the mall rests with the mall association. So that's the mall. And that's fairly typical. Inside the store, it's up to whoever the store is. Out in the hallway, it's a mall association. The tenants all pay into that, right? But the mall association runs it. Since the mall opened several years ago, business has been great, though there have been a few thorny problems. Traffic congestion has increased markedly on the adjacent highway. We're all familiar with that phenomenon, right? And the mall halls are often visited by wild riding skateboarders, sometimes in packs, sometimes just one or two at a time. They ride fast, they do jumps over benches and railways, and the bravest skateboard down the handrails of the up escalators. In street lingo, downing the up. So these are these extreme skaters, right, or aggressive skaters, as they're variously called. A mall has posted signs in many locations prohibiting skateboarding, except in an area built just 2 months ago and operated by mall the North Lake Mall Aggressive Skate Park. So they've taken a nice approach. They built a little park for the kids who do this. A large enclosed area at the west end of the mall dedicated to providing a facility for skateboarders to ply their skill. While skateboarders do use this facility, some prefer the challenge of the escalators and of avoiding the skateboard police, the team's nickname for mall security. You can imagine there are some kids who will not skate in any park that you've built for them. Right? Because that's part of the deal, is to avoid those places. Also, some of the skateboarders in the mall's hallways are teens headed for the aggressive park, but entering the mall nearer the east end. So they want to get there, but if they're coming from the east, maybe it's easier for them to skate through the halls than to skate through the parking lot. There are four mall security officers on duty at all times the mall is open, and 8 during the Christmas season. There are 18 pedestrian entrances to the mall and 8 more entrances from the adjacent parking garage. None of this, of course, would you know from just the client coming to your office to tell you she had been hurt. You'd have to go out and do this kind of fact investigation, but as I say, we have to get you started. One fine May evening at about 7 o'clock, Emma Geezer, and let me explain that name. About halfway through this course, I made a reference in class to Jimmy Carter, and it suddenly occurred to me that I had 49 people looking at me. Not one of them knew who the heck I was talking about. That's just a name in a book to them. And I said, "You people don't know Jimmy Carter?" And they said, "We're not a geezer." Oh, so I'm a geezer now. So I've heard of Jimmy Carter, so I'm a geezer. So that's where the name comes from on the exam. That was sort of their joke with me. One fine May evening, Emma Geezer, a 66-year-old widow, having just completed her purchase of a new outfit at Myrtle's Drab Creations. Isn't that a great store? Wouldn't you like to shop at Myrtle's Drab Creations? Exits the store into the mall hallway and is slammed into by a teenage skateboarder going at a very high speed, having just 20 feet ago completed downing the up. So you picture this teen guy coming down. You know how the escalator has a handrail? He's skating down the handrail, hits the floor going full speed. 20 feet later, he's just in the run out from that. Emma walks out of Myrtle's Drab Creations. Pow, down she goes. Emma is knocked down and breaks her hip. A mall security guard chases the skateboarder but cannot catch him, and he is never identified. This is a common theme in many, many legal disputes. It's called the problem of the disappearing wrongdoer, who always vamooses and leaves two relatively innocent persons to fight it out. Now, of course, the best answer is, let's find the teenager. The teenager clearly caused a lot of the problems here, although, do you suppose he'll make a very good defendant, even if we can find him? No money, right? And you can't sue parents for the torts of their children. Usually, there are some strange situations in which you can, but every night I go to bed and I say prayers for a lot of things, and one of them is, thank you that I'm not liable for the torts of my children. And I think all parents do that. Some of them might be here and they might resent that. But generally speaking, the teenager, even if we could find him, wouldn't make a very good defendant for practical reasons, although for theoretical reasons, the teenager's the best defendant, the teenagers who caused it. So who's left? The mall's left. And so we get the lawsuit, Emma suing the mall for negligence. Here's the job I want you to start with. You represent Emma, at least for the first part. Remembering that plaintiffs have a burden of postulating what the defendant should or should not have done instead, outline how you would try to argue defendant's negligence. Indicate what lines of investigation, if any, you might follow in developing your case. You have to prove that the mall was negligent, that is, that the mall did something wrong. In particular, that means Emma has to tell them all what they should have done that they didn't do, or what they should not have done that they did do. what kind of theory can Emma develop in an effort to get the mall to come up with the money to cover her damages? And by the way, you can be almost certain that the mall is carrying insurance for this purpose, right? So it'll be the mall's insurance company's lawyers who you will actually be dealing with in the case. Anybody have a place to start here? Yes, sir.
It's obvious that the mall recognized that there was this danger because they did try to take some action.
Okay, so that's important for Emma to show us that the mall knew of the problem, right? Would it be different if this was the first episode they ever had of a kid skateboarding in that mall and causing a problem? Or the first kid skateboarding in there at all?
In my mind it would, but I don't know.
Yeah. No, but I always tell the students this way, if something makes sense to you in your mind, it's probably what the law is. The trick is figuring out what the vocabulary is to get you there. But I always tell them, go with your gut. Can't stop with your gut. At some point you have to move north, right? But if it feels right in your gut, then you begin to look for what makes it right. And the law certainly would say, once the mall becomes aware that this is a big problem, they have a different kind of responsibility than the first time it happens. There's a similar rule. Anybody think of a similar rule you may have heard?
Well, but if I was from the mall's perspective, I would...
Wait, we didn't get there yet.
Okay.
We've got to do one. I've got to do Emma. All and right. Then we're going to get to the mall. Because the second question, if you look at B there, is respond to the arguments made by Emma. So that's... Oh. So, absolutely. But you're going to be the leadoff hitter
when
we get to the mall. You want to do... I like to represent the mall, too, because you get paid win or lose. You represent Emma, you only get paid if you win. So always like those defense lawyers, insurance company lawyers, they get paid either way. That's why they're so cool. You always tell the plaintiff's lawyer in the courtroom, it's like, this, you know, everything's riding on it. Insurance company, no problem. I'll let you get a quick look in. What's insurance company?
Well, I would say that I would in a preliminary motion, I would request that any prior incidents be ruled as inadmissible because it's much, and I don't know what the legal terminology or principle here is, but it would be much like a defendant in a murder case having evidence entered into his prior criminal past, same sort of thing.
Yeah, and it is true in a criminal case we'll keep prior convictions of the defendant out because it's character evidence and it's prejudicial, but here we would let it in because it helps us prove something that's very important, and that is that the defendant knew about the problem. So in this particular kind of case, prior incidents will come in because they're relevant on the issue of the knowledge of the mall, right? But you're right, in a criminal case, that's quite different. Yes?
Would this be cut and dried if there were no prior incidences, if none of this had happened, first time out of the box, Emma gets whacked here, and it's the first time anything ever happened with the skateboarder?
It would be a much harder case for the plaintiff. There are enough facts, though, in here that even if it were the first time, the plaintiff has some things to argue. Okay? Doesn't necessarily mean she'll win. But another thing you want to think about is this. Sorry, but I'm a diagram drawer. Everything in my head is a diagram. If we put the plaintiff over here and the defendant over here, and think of this semicircle as the jury or you thinking about the case, and you say, how certain are you that the plaintiff ought to win? Right? Now, there's going to be a long period of time, since the burden of proof is on the plaintiff, where you're going to say, that's not enough facts for me. If she wants to get money from the mall, she's going to have to prove a lot more than that, right? Then we're going to get to a point just here where you say, well, I don't know. Some people might think they're liable and some people might not, and you might have reasonable disagreements. Then we're going to reach a point over here where the evidence is so overwhelming that everybody would say, of course they have to pay. They knew everything about it. They took no steps. They put up placards saying, please run into old ladies. You know, imagine any whatever you want to do. And then we would... then we're all certain. Now here's what happens. The case here if that's where the case ends up in the judge's mind, the judge enters what's called a directed verdict for the defendant. The plaintiff just loses. The case doesn't get to the jury. If we get over here, we might direct a verdict for the plaintiff, and the judge will tell the jury, we don't even need you. This case is so clear, we don't need you. In the vast majority of cases, we're in this area in the middle where reasonable minds can differ, and then the judge doesn't, the jury decides the case. Now, here's the key. Even with a weak case, all Emma has to do is put in enough evidence to get here where reasonable minds can differ. And now the case goes to the jury, and if I can get that case to the jury, I like my chances. Because we have a poor woman here who's been injured. We have a defendant that in everybody's mind has plenty of money and probably has insurance. That's why there's six lawyers at that table and one at the other. Right? That's why a lot of times insurance companies are very, very good at this. They'll only put one lawyer at the table because everybody's begun to know three lawyers at the table equals...
And poorly dressed.
Huh?
And poorly dressed.
Ruth?
We've seen him try the poorly dressed trick. Yes, Mark?
I think I would make a great deal if I'm representing Emma of the fact that having known the problem, with those massive number of entrances, they've only got four security guards. This is a kind of,
right.
They've got about one security guard per every four or five entrances. And furthermore, they built this park such that it invites people to get to it through the mall. So, and they don't have security guards who could conceivably disarm people, that is, take away their skateboards.
Disfoot them, maybe.
Disfoot them.
Yeah, correct.
Guide our feet is the village.
That's right. Guide them somewhere else. Right.
Guide them down there without their skateboards until they were in the aggressive park. So that this seems to me to be, at best, a kind of token measure, but they've acknowledged the problem, so it seems to me they're in deep trouble here.
Yeah. I think the fact that there were more incidents than the mall knew of it makes the case worse.
Right.
But even without it, these kind of facts begin to add up pretty quickly to at least get us to the jury. Yes, ma'am, you had a comment.
It doesn't say anything in here about when you present your argument, are there any witnesses or surveillance cameras that you can call to testify against the wall? I mean, in the behalf of the plaintiff.
Yeah, since this course is just in torts and not evidence, I ask the students to assume that everything that's written there, we're going to find a way to prove it. That is, they will have a witness who will be able to say what this looked like and where she was. But in a real case where you're not simply given a set of facts, part of your job is to go out and find out, well, how am I going to, here's the way trial lawyers talk. How can I put the kid on the escalator? What that means is, who can I find who will testify that he was on the escalator? Can I put him on the escalator? Can I put him at the door? Right, that there was a kid at the door. Yeah. So yeah, that's right. You do have to be careful. What I want to assume here is I tell the students, if it's on this sheet, it's just true. Okay. You know, of course, in real life, if it's on this sheet, it isn't necessarily true and you have to prove it, but not every course is a course in evidence, so we have to make some assumptions.
So Emma's not scamming the ball.
Huh?
Emma's not scamming the ball.
No, Emma will have to, in fact, prove these facts. What else can we say about the mall? That they knew about the problem. Mark suggests there's a problem here with the sheer number of guards. Given how big the mall is, given the number of entrances, it doesn't seem like a lot. Especially does it not seem like a lot if you know of the problem.
Right.
If you maybe just open the mall and you don't know how much problem there's going to be, maybe it'll be a real sedate place and no one will ever, then maybe you can go down to four or even three or two. But once you know of this problem, and the park is interesting, isn't it? The skate park. It, at one level, it's an attempt to sort of cure the problem, but it may have had this unintended negative effect of drawing more people into the more dangerous areas. What else can we say here?
Do we know how many escalators there are? We know how many entrances.
We need to find out. We'll put a little thing down here called facts. I've given the student a lot of facts here, but there are a lot of other facts that would be useful to know. And I think the number of escalators is an important one, because let's say there's only one. We've got four guards. Why not just have one there all the time? This looks like a particularly dangerous kind of activity. So maybe you can deploy even a smaller number of guards in a more strategic way. What else?
Is it a problem that the security guard, not only are there too few, but the one that was involved in this case, is inept enough not to apprehend the person who did the deed?
Yeah, so the quality of the guards is called a little bit into question here. Since they sort of have a little Barney Fifeism aspect from this, right? That is, they can't even do the job they were assigned to do. They can't catch the skateboarders. Well, why don't they have some kind of motorized vehicle? Why don't they have some two-way radios to another guard?
Right.
What?
Why don't they have skateboards?
Why don't they have skateboards too, right? They could up the down. What?
They could be undercover.
That's right. They could be undercover, right? Anything else? We've got, they didn't have enough guards. They built the park to draw more. The guards don't appear to be particularly
fast
or don't have enough equipment. Any other suggestions? A number of my students came up with surveillance cameras. Because you can police this other than with just personnel. You may, with a set of surveillance cameras, be able to make four security guards act as if they're eight, or almost seem as if they're eight, right? By getting quick information about where people are coming in, where the trouble at door seven, right? Or a pack of them at door five, and then you can begin to get some things going there, so that's possible. One student that I had real trouble with said that with the right kind of camera equipment, you wouldn't need any guards at all. And I was trying to figure out what this right kind of equipment is, which would not only spot them, but then chase them down and arrest them and get them out of there. But you still have to have some people to follow up with. Yes,
sir?
Excuse me, one thing the camera would do, the camera can't catch them, but the camera can help us identify them. Right? So we may not be in this position of not knowing who it was.
Yes? Does the mall have signs posted outside directing the kids to this park without having to go through the mall?
Great.
Or will they just become wandering through looking for it?
There's all kind of signage issues here. The only sign we have is the most... is the worst kind of sign to the mall, because it's a sign that admits they know there's a problem, right? It just says no skateboarding. I can't remember where I have the sign in here. What does it say? There are signs prohibiting. So the signs say no skateboarding. It's the worst kind of signage. You know, given this kind of problem, right? The skateboarding element may not respond to signage in the first place. It might even have a sort of a reverse psychological effect in some places. How about signage for the people? Watch out for the skateboarders. How about that kind of signage?
Then you're admitting that it's a
dangerous
place.
Yeah, that's right. There's a downside to signage. But there's also a wonderful thing about signage from a defendant standpoint. And why it's always good for the plaintiff to be able to argue that the signs weren't good enough, signs are cheap. Compared to hiring another security guard at $25,000, $30,000 a year, surveillance equipment of that kind is very expensive, but signs are relatively cheap and you can get a lot of mileage out of the signs. Signs aren't a cure-all, but when a defendant doesn't have the right signs, it's even worse. You're right, though, there always is a little bit of a downside to that. But the worst situation is the one the mall is in, right? We have all kind of proof that they knew of the problem, and they didn't put up signs.
Is it legally possible for the mall to absolve itself of liability with signs?
No. No. The general rule here is that they cannot say, we are not responsible for our own negligence. Okay? The only time you get situations where people can really absolve themselves from their own negligence is if they're in a contractual relationship with somebody and it's a fair bargain and I say I'm going to relieve you of your duty to be negligent. But the one I love is, well, you see it in a lot of places, you see it in restaurants, you see it in dry cleaners and other stuff, says, not responsible for lost, stolen, or damaged goods. First of all, when I see that in the dry cleaner, I go, that doesn't look like great advertising. I'd like to go to a place who is responsible for lost, damaged, or destroyed goods, right? And as a matter of fact, the sign doesn't make them not responsible. They're still responsible if they're negligent. So here's the $64 question. Why do they put up the sign?
So you think you can't sue them?
Absolutely. So you never get to the lawyer to find out that the sign has no legal standing.
Who's
it has the effect.
For losses from a dry cleaner?
What?
Who's going to use a lawyer for losses from a dry cleaner?
Yeah, because then the lawyer will take you to the cleaners for a second time, right? Yeah. But the point is, in small claims court, that's a great small claims pro se kind of case to bring, but a lot of people say, oh boy, I could do it, but they had that sign, so I guess, the thing about small claims is you usually aren't consulting with a lawyer, and something as small as a little sign like that, they know that it will deter a large percentage of people from even thinking about suing. But for the most part, those signs are meaningless, other than the terror effect they have on people, well, can't sue them.
This case here happens to be something that is one of the target of the retailing industry's biggest losses, and that's fraudulent claims of injury mm-hmm. in their store.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the
right.
biggest cost to the insurance company for the store.
Right.
It's people who said they slipped on a broken jar or some, or the kid ran into me.
Right.
Yeah, but Mervyn, right. if she's going to be out of there with a stretcher, not walking, so you know it's fresh one.
But your assumptions are that these are facts. Yeah.
My assumptions are that these are facts, right?
Yeah. Right. You've never broken hip before.
Well, in the real world, of course, that we would have to find that out.
Yeah.
Right. We had a law student fall down on the entryway into the law school about 5 years ago. He sued us. And so we deserve it. We taught him how, right? And he had been in a car accident a week before he fell down there. So it was very difficult to sort out which injuries were from the car accident and which injuries were falling down. But yeah, there are a lot of fraudulent claim problems here. But I want to assume that these facts happen just as I say. So we're dealing with a legit set of facts, right? Let's switch over for a second to the mall. The mall's job in these cases is to show that they acted reasonably. Of course, they're very sorry that the woman is hurt. They will always act very sincere about that, especially if the jury's around, right? But what they're saying is, it's really unfortunate that this woman was hurt, but it's not our fault. We didn't do anything unreasonable. How will they respond to all of these kinds of arguments here? What kinds of things will the mall cite to us as reasons why it shouldn't have to pay? You got any thoughts, sir?
I have a question. I'm a little confused here.
Okay.
Pretend I'm Emma.
Okay.
And knowing me, I'm very naive. And I walk into this mall and I see all these no skateboarding signs, and so I'm going to assume, therefore, that of course I wouldn't get hit by a skateboard
right.
because they're doing something. Should I be assuming, gee, if these signs are there, I better be watching every store I come in and out of? Technically, which place should I be?
Well, the answer that the law gives to that is what you should be doing is what the reasonable person would do. In other words, the jury is going to be asked, was it reasonable for you as Emma to take these signs at their face value? Because one of the things that's possible here, not likely from the facts of this case, but in some cases we get a situation where we may end up saying, the defendant is at fault, the plaintiff is also at fault. The plaintiff didn't take enough steps to protect her own safety. And then what we do, in the old days, in common law England and up until about 1950, anybody know what happened in those cases? If both the defendant was negligent and the plaintiff was negligent, and the jury found they were both at fault?
Plaintiff would pay the proportionate share of the defendant's fees.
That's now.
Oh.
Then, plaintiff got nothing. If the plaintiff was negligent at all, it was a complete bar to any recovery. Okay? Now, what we say is, no, we don't do that. We've moved from what was called contributory negligence, which was a complete bar to any recovery, to what's called comparative negligence. And so what we will say to the jury is, there is 100% worth of negligence in this case. You've decided that the defendant was negligent, and you've decided that the plaintiff was negligent. How would you assign those percentages? So if they would say that the defendant is 60% and the plaintiff is 40%, then what the jury will be asked to do is to calculate of the plaintiff and to give the plaintiff 60% of those damages. In other words, to reduce the damages proportionately by the percentage. If people want to talk more about that, we can. Some states change that a little bit. In some states, once the plaintiff gets over 50%, then the plaintiff gets nothing. But in some states, the plaintiff continues to get it even if the plaintiff is more than 50%.
Does the mall have any, do they have any way of bringing the city in on this, you know, that they're not getting any help? The population has increased, traffic's increased, you know, they're doing what they can, but part of this is just the city is not helping them at all with security, police, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, certainly the defendant can add what we call a third-party defendant. Can add anyone else that they think bears any responsibility. If the mall, for example, could find the teenager, they would surely join the teenager. See, in the first instance, the plaintiff would join the teenager, but sometimes the plaintiff might say, I'm not going to join the teenager. The teenager has no money. I'm just going to sue the mall. The mall has the right to bring in the teenager, too.
What about the teenager's parents? If he's under 18, he's dependent of some adult sort of person who clearly might have money.
You generally not. Generally, the parents are not responsible unless they had a lot of pre-knowledge that the child was a terrible problem, and then they may be liable for their own negligent non-supervision. I was asking before if anybody had ever heard a statement that reminded them of that. It's an old common law saw that says, every dog gets one bite. In other words, if you own a dog, and then the dog goes and bites someone, you didn't know the dog was a biter, you're not responsible for the injury. That dog bites a second time, now you're responsible, because now you know that you have a biting dog on your hands, and now you have a duty to keep that dog from getting in contact with other persons. So sometimes you get that same thing with children. If they're chronic, then there may be some particular duty to other parents. But usually not. Usually the parents are not going to be liable here.
Is the responsibility purely on the mall, or does the mall being a public place, does the city have any responsibility?
No, in this case, the city would probably not have any responsibility at all. This is private land. And it's the job of the landowner. I think John's question was, is the city somehow contributing to the problem? Theoretically, you can add them. It's a pretty tough case to lay too much off on the city here, unless you can show the city is affirmatively doing something that's creating the problem. If, for example, the city in all its parks said, skateboarders, go to the mall. Don't be hanging around here, you know. Something like that, but usually the city's liability there won't be as much as the property owners. Yes, sir?
I would say that if I was shopping in this mall, even if I saw the no skateboarding signs, right, I might expect to be careful if one might hit me in the hall. I would never expect one to come down the escalator.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I think rules out, for the most part, contributory negligence here. There doesn't appear to be much that Emma could have done. Now, we don't know, and some students raised, we don't know the extent to which she was paying any attention at all.
Do we know her eyesight? Do we know her glasses? Do we know what her eyesight is?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing we wait, you know, did she not wear her glasses? Was she not looking, kind of walking oblivious? Maybe,
But the, you know, the facts don't say that, and we may find that, but my guess is the jury's going to have a lot of sympathy for this woman once they get the case.
Yeah, because somebody who's 66 and their whole life experience, people
yeah.
don't come down the uphill slope
right.
on the skate
park. Quite a shock. Right.
You said earlier that to kind of go with your gut and then work from that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was representing them all, I mean, there's some cogent arguments on the part of him as
right.
prosecutor also, or the lawyer, but there's my gut says that sometimes in life things just happen.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
and when they just happen, you can't always blame it on and I think the case could be made that the malls created the park to draw away these people who are going to be responsible in how they want to use the mall for skateboarding. The mall has security guards that are there to in normal situations take care of things like this.
Right.
Does a mall need to have enough security to cover any abnormal situation that can ever occur?
No. And because you can't make anything perfectly safe.
Right.
You can always imagine a way through it.
Sure. So you have to have a guard at every gate to keep any skateboarder from ever coming in the mall in order to absolve the mall from liability.
Right. In other words, the mall wants the jury to take the picture. How much can we ask of the mall? How much can we make them do? For one thing, what's the big word we're leaving out? It's the biggest word in the vocabulary of the mall's defense.
Settlement.
Well, yeah, I mean, but we're in court now.
Yeah.
If they could have settled it, they would.
Reasonable.
And the other thing is cost.
Yeah.
These are all wonderful things. What do they cost? And when we do them, how do we collect the money back? We collect it back from you, the shopper. We start kicking prices up a little bit to pay for it because we all know that the mall isn't going to end up paying for this. They're going to pass it on, right, one way or the other. So how much safety do you want? It's kind of what these cases all ask. It's kind of a way of testing people from time to time. How much safety are you willing to pay for?
I was sort of wondering, what side is Myrtle's Drab Creations on in this argument? Are they on Emma's side because they want their customers protected? And or are they on the mall side because they don't want to be higher?
It's a great question. They're not a party to the lawsuit, but sort of who they're rooting for, I think, is a function of who they're talking to. I think they'll be very sympathetic with Myrtle. At the same time, as the mall association cost goes up, the amount that Myrtle has to kick in, like every other merchant, is going to go up as well. So my guess is that this is a pretty controversial question at the mall association meeting. But the other thing is, with large concerns, like malls or big companies, they never expect that they won't be sued. They expect that they will be sued, and what they do is to try to figure out economically whether it's more sense to pay for more safety in the first instance and avoid some of the lawsuits, or to let the safety go and pay the lawsuits as they come through. And then, of course, the other part of that equation is how much can they lay off on insurance.
And we don't know how much Emma is suing for. It may be cheaper to pay her off than to...
Yes. Yeah, there may very well be, when the lawyers for both sides begin to calculate, not only get all the facts together, but also begin to calculate what their chances are, then they may begin to work toward a number that they think is a sensible number. We know that a great percentage of these kinds of cases get settled, and they get settled because basically it's uneconomic to try them, and everybody will do better with a settlement. You do, however, get some plaintiffs who are what we call dice rollers. They just want to roll the dice. They want to go for the lottery, right? But there's a lot of reasons and a lot of ways to get those plaintiffs to see that they're better off if there's a fair settlement to do it. Two other things that you didn't mention that need to go over on this side. One of the biggest things that Emma wants to find out is this: what are other malls doing? What is what we call the custom in the industry? Because it's hard to find standards on this. There won't be any statutes. that say you have, if you have a mall of this size, you have to have six guards. If you had that statute, the case is over. The mall loses. Because the statute says you must have six. They didn't. They lose. But what we can find is custom.
The mall could use that as an argument also, correct?
No, that's interesting. The fact that they're simply complying with all the statutes might be evidence that they're not negligent, but it's not proof that they're not negligent, because the statutes give us a minimum level. That's kind of the floor. If you fall below that, we know you're negligent. But if you're above that, you may or may not be negligent. So a lot of these cases, this becomes real important evidence. You get witnesses from other malls to testify what their policies are. We find that the South Lake Mall, which is 8 miles away, has the same number of doors and everything. They've got 25 security guards. That's fabulous evidence for the plaintiff suing this place that has just four. Right? The other thing that's, I think, one of the most interesting things in a lot of these cases that are safety cases, one of the ways that you make it safer is with physical barriers. That is, you erect physical things that makes it impossible for people to do things. And so a lot of the students raise, well, you could, and now they had to get very inventive. How do you engineer the escalator so that you cannot skateboard down the handrail without creating the specter of, you know, 30 mangled hand losses, right? So there's always these trade-offs. You can maybe make it safer for one particular risk, and the doing of that makes it worse for another kind of risk. It's what planners call a polycentric problem. That is, it's got stuff coming from all sides, and you can't figure out which risk to worry about. The other great thing about it here is, and it's why I use skateboarders. Anybody see it? Physical barriers to skateboarders are just another part of the apparatus on which they operate. Yeah, so they're the very last kind of group that you can use physical barriers on, because the barrier itself just becomes part of the overall game. I put a little formula up here, and it's generally understood to be the sort of economic meaning of negligence. And what we're saying here is this. What we're testing for is whether B is more or less than P and L, all of which helps you greatly not knowing what P and L stand for, right? But P is the probability of injury. Okay. So how likely is it that from this particular condition someone will be hurt? L is what will the loss be? In other words, how much will they be hurt? So it's the probability of injury times the amount of the injury. That's one side of the equation. And the B on the other side is what's the burden to the defendant of changing the behavior. In other words, we might say, let's argue that the mall should have had six guards instead of four. Well, we can figure out pretty quickly what it costs to employ two guards for a year. Right? We can come up with an actual number for that. Then we can compare that against things like the probability that we will reduce the amount of accidents by hiring that, and we can get this up. What I'm trying to say there, and this formula is wonderful, except usually we don't have enough numbers to make it work. So really all it is a symbolic expression of, we require people to provide so much safety, but not an unreasonable amount of safety. This is, you know, how do you make, for example, a car that won't hurt anybody under any circumstances when the car is hit? First of all, even if you could theoretically make such a car, what would it cost? What would it look like? Right? What kind of gasoline mileage would it get? What would it do to the roads, right? So it's always a balancing of the cost against the probability of harm. So that's always what the parties are arguing about in a negligence case. Then I ask the students finally at the end, now you're the judge. Briefly indicate whether you would direct a verdict either for plaintiff or defendant, or instead let the case go to the jury. This is almost certainly a case that goes to the jury. There's enough facts for either side that you can make a reasonable argument that the plaintiff should win or the plaintiff should lose. It's a wonderful case to let the jury sort out.
One thing that seems to be
in my lifetime, which is significant enough, that,
that you can't be more judges, than 24.
Judges are tending to come more and more down so that anything, everything goes to the jury anymore. Judges don't do anything else.
Yeah, but there are certain kinds of cases in which you'll see a lot of directed verdicts. You will see very few in a case like this. For one thing, if the case is that weak, it wouldn't have been brought in the first place. Or if it's that strong, the defendant would have settled it out already. So usually the process has a way of shedding the cases that are no-brainers in either direction and leaving for trial the ones where there is a legitimate dispute. I'm going to say you may shut off the tape. Vespers is in 10 minutes, but I'm going to stay here for a few minutes for anybody who has questions. And thank you for the attention. Yes?
In this day and age, wouldn't the jury go for Emma?